from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support from listeners like you. And from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts, opening in January 2011.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Sharon Gamble. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Travis DiNicola. Today we're going to revisit three interviews that dealt with subjects we consider pretty significant to the local arts community during this past year.
We'll start with my talk with Priscilla Lindsay, who left the IRT to go to the University of Michigan.
Then I'll chat with Stephen Libman, the president and CEO of the Center for the Performing Arts in Carmel.
And I'll chat with Lisa Fryman about the 100 Acres Park at the IMA. And we'll have our arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. For our year-end show, we're revisiting interviews that dealt with significant moments in the arts community this past year. The Indianapolis theater scene saw two of its pillars move on to new adventures over the last year. First, John Green left his position as Butler University's theater department chair to become chair of theater at Chicago's Columbia College. Then Priscilla Lindsay answered the call of the North as well to become chair of theater at the University of Michigan. Sharon Gamble invited Priscilla to our studios during her final week in Indy last summer to find out what she learned in her decades at the IRT and what she plans for her career in Ann Arbor and beyond.
All right, so repeat after me. Change is good.
Change is good.
get in the Wayback Machine. Go back a few years, though, and talk to me about how theater grabbed a hold of you in the first place.
At the very beginning?
At the very beginning.
Let's see. Probably real live theater, not just me playing around with my sisters, you know, when we were growing up, doing shows for my neighbors and my mom and dad. But I would say, well, junior high in Evanston, Illinois. I had moved from Ohio to Evanston and got a chance to be on a costume crew.
Ooh.
For a production of a play called Yellow Hand, which is probably not at all PC in this day and age, but was about a Native American Indian who was a bad guy.
Huh.
But in any event, I was on the costume crew, and that did it. I stood backstage all those shows and watched what was happening and was just said, this is it.
What was it that grabbed you? What was it about it that you
think
said?
The mystery of it, the excitement of it, the magic. The fact that the actors were so intense and believed in it so much, and that was something I love to do as well.
Mm-hmm.
Step into somebody else's skin and take on another character. So I think a lot of actors are kind of shy in real life.
Yeah.
And I was.
Yeah.
As
our listeners know, I work at the Phoenix Theater for my day job, and Dave Ruark, who works for you guys now,
absolutely,
used to work for us. He's a wonderful actor, but when he was at the Phoenix, he said he always dreaded doing the curtain talk, and I said, why? And it's because you're not a character when you're doing the curtain. You're just
That's
yourself.
Right. That's
so
exactly
it's,
right. Same thing.
Kind of typical, yeah. You know, a lot of people, after the first few years, kind of self-select either actors or directors, but it strikes me about your career that you've kind of moved seamlessly between those two roles. Is there, how do you do that? How do you switch gears?
It takes a different part of the brain.
Really?
I have learned that. Yeah, it really does. As a director, you are more in the manager slot. You have to see with a much more critical eye. You have to see the whole picture as well as the little stuff. You have to be much more of a people person in a general sense, being able to inspire actors, also figure out how they work so that you can attempt to get the performance you want in the way, get them to hear you the way that you want them to hear you. And that's not the same for all actors.
And it probably changes even by production. The same actor might communicate a different way depending on who his or her castmates might be.
Yeah, that's probably true. As an actor, there's a certain kind of freedom. It's more of a sense of play.
I have my lines. I'm just showing up.
Yeah. Well, it's hard work, but it's the best kind of work.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. How did you end up at the IRT?
Oh, my goodness. My husband and I started off after we did graduate work at University of Michigan, and we first landed in Houston, Texas at the Alley Theater. Mm-hmm. And I was what would be called a journeyman or an intern down there. So as well as having a role, I swept the floor and, you know, all that kind of good stuff, swept the stage. And my husband, Richard, worked in the scene shop. So we both were employed together. And then he was hired to go to the Missouri rep after that as a resident scene designer for their company. And I followed after I finished up at the Alley, auditioned, got in that company. And then he was hired here by that early triumvirate of founders, Ben Mordecai, Ed Stern, and Greg Poggi, who founded IRT, and they asked him to be the resident scene designer here. That would have been the 73-74 season. Mm-hmm. So then I finished up at Missouri Rep, came here, auditioned for the 74-75 season, got in, and there you go.
And the rest is history.
Yeah.
And a few dozen roles later.
Indeed.
As well as all of your associate artistic director responsibilities, and when help us understand
right.
when that came into play.
Just about almost 12 years ago was when Janet Allen asked me to be associate artistic director. Before then, you know, acting in seasons and so forth, a little bit of directing, but most of that started after Janet asked me.
Do you have tell us what is the role of the associate artistic director?
Ah, we're now trying to transfer that to other people in place, so it's a little bit top of mind.
So you find yourself doing, oh, and by the way, you need to know this, and you need
exactly.
to do this, and you need to do this.
Exactly. It's going to morph, I must say. Every
sure.
artistic or every artistic director at the IRT has devised and created this associate artistic role to suit not only that artistic director, but also the personality and skills of whoever held that position. So I know it will change again. But my main jobs are helping with the casting of all the plays, holding auditions both locally and in, you know, the major cities with whom we have casting relationships with, and then also seeing anyone who comes through town, actors who come through every week, I will see, keeping those files up to date. I also help with season choices. She, mm-hmm. Janet is wonderful. We start reading plays in about early November, and we sit down quite often to discuss what we think, how that play would benefit the city, the state, our theater, our subscribers, where it fits in Janet's scheme, plan, and how she feels about it. I also run the Young Playwrights in Process contest for junior high and high school playwrights. This is a wonderful event. It's in its sixth year, I think, this year. Young writers submit their plays from now until about December 1st, and then we have a couple of adjudicating sessions, and the final choice is made in April. So it's like almost a year-round activity. I also run the Summer Conservatory for Youth, which just finished last week. 76 students aged 8 through 18, 4 weeks, 9 to 5 every day, intensive training in the process of theater.
Wow, that's a lot.
It is, but it's such great fun. And the children are amazing. They're just amazing. We divide them up into 8 to 10, 11 to 13, and 14 to 18-year-old groups. We also have a production side as well as the acting side. So the production side does playwriting, directing, scene design, lighting design, costumes, props, and some stage management is thrown in there as well. So those things, let's see, sort of Janet's right-hand gal is what I end up being, whatever's needed at the time. Obviously, I'm a member of the senior staff, so meetings to deal with issues that come up internally, and also strategic planning, interfacing with the board of directors. We have a wonderful board of directors, about 37 strong.
It's astonishing that you've found time while wearing that hat to take on roles as well.
True. She's been very kind, but we both knew at the beginning that I was going to want to do at least one role a year.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's, we've just carved that time out, mm-hmm. and everybody else kind of picks up the slack. We try to make it a play that isn't at the beginning of the season when things are crazy. a role that I can do. And then obviously I direct Christmas Carol and then one other show usually as well.
Mm-hmm. When you were just starting out, did you, I'm curious about this with all artists, but especially for you, did you come up with a list of great roles you wanted to take on as you became old enough or at the right stage of life to take them on? Did you have kind of a, here are my 100 roles I must do during my lifetime? Or have you has it been a more organic process of, ooh, this cool new play is available, you know, you doubt wasn't around when
exactly.
you were making that list a few years ago?
Exactly. The latter. I never did make a list. In fact, I'm a little skittish about doing that, kind of as if it were bad luck. I don't want to go after a role necessarily very often. Now, if I were in a different situation where I had to solicit that kind of stuff, I'm sure I would change my mind. But I feel at this point that, you know, often the role that you think you're just perfect for, that you are dying to play, is the one that isn't going to pan out. And the role that you maybe weren't expecting to be offered, and maybe you don't think it's quite the right fit, that's when you make the discoveries. That's when, you know, if you're on kind of a plateau as actors get on, when things seem to be, they're fine, but you're not really in a growth situation, and something hits you the right way, or a director challenges you, and boom, you kick it up a notch.
Please make sure you convey that to all your students and all of your faculty when you get in your new job, because that's what a great life lesson.
Yeah, I think so, too.
As we're having this conversation, you have a season brochure for next season.
Which
this is your baby that you helped birth. But I have the feeling once you get up and settled in Ann Arbor, you're not going to have a lot of time to be coming back and forth. Are you committed?
I'm not.
Are you able? You're not able to direct anything in the coming season.
No, I'm not. No, unfortunately, I'm not. But they're going to do just great.
How much time? Talk about, obviously, as department chair, you'll spend a lot of time in administrative duties. Will you have some time to teach? Will you be able to teach?
Absolutely.
Will you be able to direct?
Yes, both of those things. I won't do either till the second semester, and then I'll teach acting starting the second semester, and then next year I'll help to choose that season and direct in that season and hopefully teach some acting and maybe some directing as well. Mm-hmm. It's a wonderful department.
It's certainly, I think you'll certainly have plenty of very, very bright students and faculty around
indeed,
you.
Indeed. They're terrific. And three beautiful theaters to work out of, so that's fun, too.
Well, break a leg from everybody in the Indianapolis community.
Goodness.
I say that with mixed feelings. We don't want you to go, but, you know, it's a great opportunity for you.
I feel the same way. There's so little that would ever make me consider leaving, and when this came up, I thought, you know, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. I've got to do it, and my husband and I are looking forward to the adventure of it, but we are going to miss everyone here.
Sharon Gamble with Priscilla Lindsay, now chair of the theater department at the University of Michigan.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. If you've been listening lately to The Art of the Matter, you've certainly heard about the Palladium sponsorship of this show. And if you live or work in Carmel, you've probably driven by the construction site for the new Center for the Performing Arts where the Palladium is located. But what exactly is the center, what will be taking place there, and what's the big deal about this so-called American Songbook? Last August, Travis DiNicola spoke with Stephen B. Libman, the president and chief executive officer of the Center for the Performing Arts, to make sense of it all.
For full disclosure, the Palladium is a great sponsor of Art of the Matter this year, so I will just say thank you for that.
You're very welcome. We're glad to be a part of the cultural landscape of Central Indiana.
I really want to use this opportunity to chat with you to especially for our listeners who are not exactly familiar with the Palladium and the whole Center for the Performing Arts in Carmel, to really help us understand it a little bit better. And let me just start by saying that, you know, just a couple weeks ago I was at a show, Jersey Boys, when it was
mm-hmm.
in town,
right.
And I overheard a conversation of a couple of people talking, and I was like, oh, this is a great show, which it was. And, you know, oh, is this what you think they'll have shows like this up at the Palladium when it opens? And, you know, and I immediately, like, and, you know, turned around and said, you know what, they may have shows, they have a theater up there, but the Palladium isn't actually for theatrical productions.
Right.
It's for music. So help us understand that a little bit better, because I know there is some confusion.
Well, first, I'm glad you saw Jersey Boys, which is a show we created when I was at La Jolla Playhouse.
So oh,
we're
very, fantastic.
Very proud of that production. We will not be doing road shows, touring Broadway productions. That's not what any of our three venues can
anything
can
at
handle.
The center is not
right.
going to be doing.
Nothing
that.
At the center will be handling touring Broadway material. The Palladium is the 1,600-seat concert hall, and as a concert hall, it is designed primarily for musical performances. We will be bringing in solo artists, great orchestras. It's the home to the Carmel Symphony Orchestra. In addition, the Indianapolis Wind Symphony will perform there. The Indianapolis Chamber Orchestra. Anyone who has anything to do with classical music will probably want to perform in the Palladium because it is designed as to be an acoustically perfect concert hall. Plus, we'll have a country series there, a Great American Songbook series curated by Michael Feinstein, and a jazz series. So music is really the art form that will weave its way through the Palladium. We'll do some dance. We can also do opera. But it's really not set up for theater because we don't have a proscenium and we don't have wings. However, the
and,
other
and for those of those people who are say, what's a proscenium and wings? Just to be clear about that. Yeah, essentially, and I've been very fortunate enough I could get a tour of the space a couple months ago as it's still being created. And there's a very large stage, but there's no fly space above the stage. There's no space off to the sides.
Correct.
There's no area to fly in sets or big curtains or anything like that.
The proscenium, basically, in any theater, if you look at Indianapolis Repertory Theater, for example, a proscenium creates two spaces, the stage space, and when the curtain is down, then the audience space. In a concert hall, everyone is in the same space. You're all in the exact same room, and the stage juts out into the audience, really.
Yes.
So there's no fly space. Fly space is the area where scenery goes up and down.
Mm-hmm.
So there's none of that. And because we don't have a proscenium, there's no wing space. Wing spaces are the parts on stage right and stage left that the audience doesn't see. That's where the actors and the dancers go when they're not on stage. And that's where scenery can go when it's not on stage. We don't have that in the Palladium because it's all everyone's
that's
in one space.
That's not what it's designed for.
Exactly. That's not what it's designed
for. And though you could, I'm sure, have speakers or perhaps one-man shows or things like that, which you may do, again, it's designed, it's for the acoustics.
The Palladium is designed to be an acoustically perfect concert hall. We've been told, and we'll study this soon, and I want to talk about the tuning of the hall, that you could actually hear your heart beat when all the doors are closed and there's silence in the room. And it is designed so that music dominates what happens in that hall. And I also want to mention we have two other venues.
Right.
The Palladium opens in January.
Mm-hmm.
The 200-seat Studio Theater opens in March. And the Studio Theater is designed to be a flexible space. We can have four or five different seating configurations. It's an ideal venue for emerging artists. And any genre can work there. We will do jazz concerts, classical concerts, theater, and dance. The 500-seat theater is your traditional proscenium theater.
And that's the Tarkington.
That's
right?
Exactly. The 500-seat theater is the Tarkington. It is the primary home of the Civic Theater. But there will be, between the three venues, seven resident companies who will perform in those three venues on a regular basis. Interestingly enough, in the Tarkington Theater, while we won't do Broadway shows, that stage is, in fact, large enough to accommodate a Broadway show.
Okay.
And Michael Feinstein and I have talked about creating original material here in central Indiana, out of the gazing eyes of the media on either coast, and then we would transfer that material commercially, perhaps, to Broadway.
To that space.
So while we will not do a Broadway roadshow like Jersey Boys, we could, however, engage in an effort to create shows like Jersey Boys, and we think that that's pretty.
That'd be pretty cool. So, just to be cool, and or just be, to reiterate and to be clear here, so the Center for Performing Arts essentially it's a large plaza consisting of a number of buildings. Three different performance spaces,
correct.
And the first one that's going to open up is the Palladium.
Exactly. The Palladium is the first space to open up in January 2011.
Now, I want to say that there were three things that really stood out for me when I got my tour a couple months ago, talking about this acoustically perfect space. Mm-hmm. One of the things was just the craftsmanship that was going in to the plaster and to make sure that the plaster was so thick and perfect and, you know, these, like, fourth-generation craftsmen working on that. The second thing was that the interior space, and correct me in any of this, please, is essentially an enormous sort of cement cube, if you will, of like, you know, 12-inch cement walls. It's sort of like a building within a building.
Correct.
And the final thing that, and this just amazed me, was that, and what I was told was that the physical plant machinery, like air conditioners mm-hmm. and heaters, is actually sort of on these springboards so that the vibrations don't go into the rest of the building?
All of that is correct. This building was
That's all pretty cool stuff.
It's amazing. There's not another performing arts center or building like the Palladium being constructed in the entire Western Hemisphere right now like this. Mm-hmm. There could be one in the future, but there's nothing being built like this now. The exterior is comprised of all hand-carved Indiana limestone. Artisans hand-carved every block. Every column that you see is hand-carved, and if you stand on the steps of the Palladium and study those columns, you'll see that not every line is exactly parallel. Well, that's okay, because yeah. it was hand-carved.
And Indiana limestone.
And Indiana, all which, Indiana limestone. Yeah. When you enter the building, there will be gorgeous Italian marble on the floor, and that's for the exterior lobby space.
Mm-hmm.
Then when you enter the other building, as you referred to it, you walk through doorways that are 2 feet thick.
Okay.
That wow. creates the separation between the outer lobby and the concert hall space, which is why they say you could fire a gun in the lobby and you will not hear it yeah. inside the concert hall.
Which leaves, it could be a really interesting murder mystery, but anyway.
Right. That could be an interesting yeah. murder mystery.
Now, one of the, I think, the most exciting things, I'm sure, for you is you're planning all the activities that lead up to the official opening of the Palladium, which is going to happen in January 2011. This fall, you're actually doing a series of what are called tuning concerts.
Correct.
And help me understand this, because I know that part of what's going to make the Palladium so versatile with the sound are these large sort of glass panels that hang. But you got to figure out like how to move them for different types of music?
Exactly. Everything that takes place in that building is immense. And just to talk for a second, you mentioned the heating and ventilation system. Technically, part of it is about almost a quarter mile away from us. So that the cold and hot water is piped underground to the Palladium so that when the air conditioning and heating system is turned on, you won't hear anything.
You guys really did think of everything.
They thought of everything. There are enormous fans in the basement. Everything is on springs yeah. so that there's no vibration. And the fans are so large. Apparently, these are the fans that are used on aircraft carriers. These are enormous fans to move tremendous volumes of air without any sound. Now, back to the tuning of the hall. We have this amazing concert hall. And on November 8th, we receive what's called the Certificate of Occupancy. And that's when my staff can go to work and figure out how to use everything in that building. Sound equipment, lighting equipment, rigging equipment. We have to figure out how to use the box office, how to make sure the ushers can seat people properly, that the scanners work well when you come into the building, that we scan your tickets. And, as you mentioned, we tune the hall for music. There are glass panels inside the concert hall that can raise and lower at different levels.
Mm-hmm.
As we speak now, we don't know what those levels are going to be, but we're working with 50 local arts organizations, everything from gospel choirs to jazz, bluegrass, rock, classical music. The Indianapolis Symphony will come up and help us tune the hall, the Chamber Orchestra, the Carmel Symphony. We will, through these 3 months, November, December, and January, figure out what's the best level for each of these genres. So for classical music, an orchestra with 120 musicians will be different from a solo artist with a single violin, which is different from jazz and different from rock.
Will you actually create, if you will, presets then?
Yes.
So that, you know, the computer knows, like, oh, you've got a jazz band with bass and piano and drums, and so, you know, this is preset 367?
I think probably an oversimplification, but that's about right. We will, through 3 months of testing through these 50 concerts, we will know so that when we bring in, say, an orchestra from Europe, we can't take the time to have them come in and rehearse for a week. They're going to arrive Friday morning, and they have to be ready to go Friday night.
Mm-hmm.
We will, in a sense, pull out our playbook and say, okay, for an orchestra that seats 120 musicians on that stage, this is the optimal level for the acoustical tile, the acoustical glass, and we also have curtains that go around the building. Those curtains are not used often if it's all acoustic and will be used if it's amplified sound. But we don't know if they'll be halfway, partway, all the way until we get in there and test it.
This is going to be kind of a fun experiment, I would think, for the arts organizations participating, because essentially they'll be coming in, and my understanding is they'll be able to, you know, invite audiences to come and hear this. But as they're playing, you'll be starting and stopping them and making adjustments.
Right.
And
the audiences are participating in a very important process. First, these performances are all private. They're not advertised to the public. So if you're the Carmel Symphony or, say, the Indianapolis Symphony, you will invite your patrons and your audience members to this performance. We'll have reserved tickets in advance so that we can practice and figure out how to seat people in the hall. And there may, in fact, be a lot of stopping and starting. The acousticians, Artek from New York City, may say, please, maestro, can you go back and do that again? We need to hear the percussion again, because then they can adjust. And that will work because we'll probably interview people and say, can you hear this? We'll have sensitive equipment throughout the hall. And a lot of us are going to be running around the hall so that we can sit in almost every section. Ideally, it shouldn't matter where you sit in that concert hall. The sound needs to be the same.
Mm-hmm.
But it's going to take 3 months' worth of work to make that happen.
Of course, of course. Wow, what a great process.
It's an incredible process. And we think, we know, that we're going to become an important part of the cultural landscape of this community. And every organization I arrived here in September, I have been in touch with and had meetings with, I would say, representatives of almost every music organization.
Mm-hmm.
And without a doubt, everyone is excited about the Palladium and cannot wait to get in there. And it's sort of like driving a Maserati. They cannot wait to test drive this amazing vehicle. And what Carmel is sort of giving the community is this amazing gift of music. And it is our job to make sure that local organizations can use the space as often as they want to, and that we will bring to Indiana the finest music that the world has to offer. What's interesting is prior to the construction of the Palladium, a lot of major arts organizations skipped over Indiana because there wasn't a performing arts center like this. We're now going to become part of major international tour routes. We're not ready to announce our season yet because we're still putting it together, but we are bringing in, for example, one orchestra that's kicking off their U.S. tour here in Indiana. Major orchestra. That never would have happened without the construction of the Palladium. And we also view that it's very important that we partner with local organizations.
Mm-hmm.
So for any group that we bring in from the outside, we intend to create a partnership with local arts organizations so that their audiences can have the opportunity to view these amazing artists.
Let me ask you about another element of the Palladium, and that is Michael Feinstein's role. There's been a lot of talk about Feinstein's Great American Songbook and how it's going to be there at the Palladium.
Yes.
And again, referencing someone I was talking to just a week ago said, now, wait, so he is like this big book of songs that they're going to have on display? And I said, well, it's a little bit more than that. Essentially, it is a museum-quality collection of, what, music, memorabilia, ephemera that Feinstein's put together?
It is. I mean, Michael is really the premier interpreter of the Great American Songbook, and he performs this unique American art form all over the world. So it's wonderful to partner with Michael. He's a great artist, and I thoroughly enjoy working with him. His collection, which is the largest collection of memorabilia affiliated with the Great American Songbook, is coming here. So what does that mean? It's original sheet music from George and Ira Gershwin and Irving Berlin. It's the rehearsal tapes from Rosemary Clooney. Michael has 10,078s that have yet to be cataloged in his home in New York City. This collection is spread throughout. It's in his home in L.A., his mother's house in Los Angeles, a warehouse in Los Angeles, his home in New York, warehouses in New York and in New Jersey.
I'm guessing his mom's pretty happy about moving the collection out, then.
I think his mother probably is. The collection would fill a 70,000-square-foot building.
Wow.
We will have on display a small percentage of that collection.
Okay.
What's exciting, though, is this unique American treasure, it really is an American treasure, is moving to Indiana. And this is, in many ways, part of the birthplace of the Great American Songbook. Artists like Hokie Carmichael and Cole Porter were born here.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, people often say, well, Stephen, is there an audience for music in central Indiana? I'm new to this community, but maybe there's something in the water here. But look at what we have when it comes to music. In addition to Hokie Carmichael and Cole Porter, this is the headquarters for the International Violin Competition, the American Pianist Association, the Indianapolis Symphony, the Carmel Symphony. School of Music at IU and Butler, two outstanding universities. Mm-hmm. So there's something pretty special about music that's happening in this community, and we're happy to become a part of that.
That's great. Now with his songbook, with this collection, would it be a rotating exhibit? Will there be, you know, you mentioned like these recordings. Will there be an opportunity to actually listen to it? Will scholars be coming here? And
ultimately, if you're familiar with, the Huntington Museum in Pasadena, which has one of the world's great collections of manuscripts and books, if you're a scholar, you have the opportunity to go back into the archives and actually touch and read and study those manuscripts. It is Michael's goal to do the same thing here. Mm-hmm. If you're a scholar, you'll be able to have access to these very rare archives. In addition, those archives will be digitized. So you can be a scholar in Moscow and pull up Irving Berlin's original sheet music and actually turn the pages online.
Wow, okay.
And the entire collection will be digitized that way. The goal is to have this collection, parts of this collection, on tour really throughout the world, because we just couldn't display everything here. And Michael is sort of an evangelist about the Great American Songbook. Mm-hmm. We all believe passionately in this art form because it's part of jazz, it's part of Broadway music and film music, and it is America's unique contribution to the performing arts.
Travis DiNicola with Stephen B. Libman, the President and Chief Executive Officer of the Center for the Performing Arts in Carmel. For more information about the center, visit thecenterfortheperformingarts.org. Again, thecenterfortheperformingarts.org. The opening night gala for the Palladium will take place on January 29th, 2011. 3, 2, 1. Happy New Year,
Sharon. We had a big ball that was dropping right over WFYI studios.
That's right.
Right.
It was not made of imported Irish crystal, though.
No.
It was made of paper cranes, symbolizing peace
for the
new year.
Oh, I love
it.
What a nice idea. Well, Happy New Year, Sharon.
And happy New Year to you.
New Year to all of our listeners. And I think a great way to celebrate the New Year is to think about what you're going to go see, if not this New Year, at least this coming weekend.
I love it.
What'll we do? Okay.
What do you have?
What do we do in 2011? Phoenix Theater is opening up the play Norway. This is a co-world premiere of the play Norway, written by Samuel Hunter, and it opens on January 6th, runs through the 30th. It's not actually about Norway, but it is about families and people in a family and friends and a father and the past and the future and secrets and the type of drama that only the Phoenix can do. Definitely worth checking out at the Phoenix Theater.
You know, Travis, you ain't nothing but a hound dog.
Aw, shit.
Don't be cruel.
You say the nicest thing.
We'll return you to sender, and it's really now or never if you really want to see Elvis songs set with choreography, modern dance choreography. Yep, it's Dance Kaleidoscope's The Elvis Project, and it's coming up this coming weekend at the IRT. A lot of fun. I mean, how could you resist? Elvis in Love is one of the pieces. Taking Care of Business is another one. And I can't do it. You do it for me. Thank you very much. you're really good at that. So that'll give you a sneak peek at some of the pieces you'll see if you go see The Elvis Project. DK at the IRT this
That'll
coming weekend.
That'll be a lot
weekend.
Of fun. That'll
yep.
be great.
Yep.
The Cabaret at the Columbia Club is presenting a concert coming up this weekend. Three-time Grammy nominees, the Tierney Sutton Band, known for their very sort of bold interpretation of jazz standards. They've got a new CD called Desire featuring Cry Me a River and It's All Right With Me, Fever, and Skylark. And they are performing both Friday and Saturday evenings, Friday the 7th, Saturday the 8th, 8 p.m. at Cabaret at the Columbia Club.
Excellent. Hey, your time is growing short. If you're rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic, you need to stop doing that and get yourself over to the State Museum in the final days and hours of the Artifact Exhibition, Titanic the Artifact Exhibition.
Great exhibit.
Fascinating. And also kind of interactive. You get to become one of the passengers, and at the end of the exhibit, you find out what happened.
I did not survive
when
I went through. I found
you
out.
You didn't?
No, I did not. That's all I'm going to say.
Well, maybe you should go back and see if you have better luck. Check out the State Museum's website for more info about that.
Hey, if you would like to be in a show, the Civic Theater is holding auditions on January 3rd and 4th, right around the corner, for both Cabaret and Miss Saigon. If you go to the Civic Theater's website, you can find out more information about when the auditions are and what roles are available. And again, that's at the Civic Theater for Cabaret and Miss Saigon. Auditions coming up the 3rd and 4th.
Ensemble Voltaire is presenting a concert in a couple weeks on January 14th and 16th. It's called, you'll love this, Telemania. It's music of Telemann, sonatas, trios, and quartets by Telemann. On Friday the 14th, you can hear the concert at Trinity Episcopal Church at 7:30, and then on Sunday the 16th, you can hear the concert at the historic Athenaeum at 2 o'clock. Telemann, we've kind of forgotten, but in his day, he was Europe's most celebrated and esteemed composer. He even eclipsed J.S. Bach's popularity. So check out Ensemble Voltaire to find out why Telemann was all the mania.
Very cool. Hey, last thing I got is just to let you know that the Athenaeum, the Y at the Athenaeum, which did have that big crane. Speaking of cranes, you were talking about paper cranes.
I was. Remember,
they had a different type of crane.
They had
fell into the roof.
The
anyway,
guy.
Right. They are having a big grand reopening on January 10th, so that will be fun to celebrate.
Very good. We will have so much more throughout 2011 that you can go and see and do and try and hear, including coverage of some of the new events that will be at the almost ready to open Palladium.
That's right.
But stay tuned for future editions of
What'll We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
Since coming to Indianapolis a few years ago, Lisa Fryman has been wearing many hats. This IMA curator of contemporary art also presides over the new 100 acres Virginia B. Fairbanks Art and Nature Park. And Sharon Gamble lured Lisa away from her work for a conversation about the significance of the IMA's largest new project.
Early on, I read a study that spoke about the fact that the number one reason people make return visits to museums is for changing exhibitions. And that idea, coupled with the question of what is a 21st century park, really set me on my way. And what I mean by that is I realized that if we wanted to be more than just a community asset, which I knew we were going to be no matter what we did, because it was going to provide a place for the Indianapolis community and the regional community to come that was unique, how would we get people to come back here? How would we get people to make Indianapolis a destination on a national and even an international level? And since Indianapolis is not a huge tourist destination, that's a tricky question. And the idea of changing things out and making the park be sort of acknowledge its state of constant transformation seemed to be a way to really set the park apart from other initiatives throughout the United States. And then As I benchmarked with other institutions, I realized that there really was no sculpture park in the United States that focused all on commissioned site responsive work.
Really?
Yeah, there's
that's surprising to me.
Yeah, it's a lot of work to do commissioned projects with living artists.
Sure.
And you know, you were asking a great question before about sort of the interdisciplinary nature of landscape architecture and art and how that worked out, but it goes even beyond that in a project like this, because you also have engineers and structural engineers and electricians and concrete masons and steel workers, and I mean it's been the most interdisciplinary thing I've ever worked on because of the nature of commissioning everything from scratch and then having to problem solve and figure out how to actually build these things, because some of them, I mean all of them, none of them have ever been built before. And so, you know, when we met with initial code consultants and architects and engineers on some of the projects, they were, you know, shaking their head, just saying, you can't do this. And for me, whenever somebody says you can't do something, it's the perfect storm. I mean, it's the thing that makes me want to do it even more. I get my back up. I'm like, we're going to figure out a way to do this, because it's not that anything's possible, but, you know, human beings are pretty industrious and creative. And I wanted the IMA to be known for being a place that was willing to to embrace challenges and also to make artists' dreams come true. It's, you know, I was joking about the recession with you earlier in terms of jobs, but if you think about artists as professionals, which they are, they have fewer and fewer opportunities to do work in a public scale, especially in a time like this where public monies are constricting so much. And so it seemed to me that one of the things that could be really exciting and that tied into my mission as the head of the contemporary program at the IMA was to really give artists a platform to play and to challenge themselves and to challenge the public and to question what is the role of art in relation to the 21st century. How does it play out? You know, what are the different possibilities for it? How do you define it? And, you know, a lot of people, I think, I think the stereotype is that a lot of people feel threatened with contemporary art. But I think the reality is that if you're someone who works in a museum and you see publics coming through and school groups coming through, the thing that people take to most automatically in general is the contemporary work, particularly the kids, because they don't have preconceived notions about what art is or what art is supposed to be. And so I wanted to create a park that really put that question at the forefront and also figured out a way to put art projects forward that would appeal to a truly diverse audience. And I don't mean that in a kind of superficial way, but I mean in terms of every kind of background, every kind of orientation, every kind of mindset, giving people a touchstone, something to react to, something to have a dialogue about. And kids were very much at the heart of the way I was thinking about it, because my training is contemporary art, particularly history, and the decade that I worked on the most is the 1960s. And during the 1960s, there were a lot of artists, and the 50s as well, who were celebrating the unconscious and thinking about ways that they could make art that would somehow convey the unconscious in an immediate sort of uncensored fashion. And one of the places that they looked, of course, like the surrealists in the 30s, was to the art of children and also the mentally ill, because they found that kids in particular, would draw in a way that was completely free.
And they don't edit themselves.
Yeah. And they also look that way. They see things that way. They experience the world that way. They don't, I mean, I have a 4-year-old and a 6-year-old, and, you know, they just are immediately who they are and without any kind of concern for society or any kind of repercussions of opinions or taste-making or anything like that. And that's an incredibly freeing state to be in. And it's been really fun watching the park under construction. We haven't closed it off. It's been open to the public the whole time. And so sort of the people who've always used it have continued to use it. And then we've brought, you know, other people have sort of come by out of curiosity. And you see people of all different backgrounds, you know, Mexicans and African-Americans and kids and mothers with strollers. And, you know, it's and some people are fishing and, you know, some people are playing Frisbee and some people are jogging and
Which leads me to a question. What do we know about people? Do people come with a different mindset to come inside a museum as opposed to outside a museum?
I think so. I mean, it's really hard to generalize with
sure.
that. But I think it's safe to say anyone who's ever walked into a museum knows that there are particular rules. You know, you can't run. You're not supposed to touch the work. You really shouldn't be screaming at the top of your lungs. I mean, there's certain, you know, appropriate behaviors. And again, those are really difficult for children. You know, even as a curator, when I bring my children through my own galleries, I have to be careful to make sure they don't, you know, bulldoze the artwork. and you know, I mean, it's very humbling to be a curator and bring your own kids into galleries and realize what everyone else is going through when it's not your time with your kids. But you know, I think that one of the things that the park has to offer is the absolute opposite of that, that there are no walls. It's a free space. You know, the IMA is free to the public also, but But this is also metaphorically free space where people can run, they can wander, they can eat, they can engage with the art by touching it. I mean, many of the projects in the park are meant to be interactive or are produced through, have been produced through some kind of a community practice. For example, Alfredo Jarre, a Chilean artist who's based in New York, has done a project called Park of the Laments. It's essentially, I think it's the most metaphoric and poetic project that we have in the park across the board. But what he's done is he's created a place for people to reflect, to meditate. It's a place of silence. And the formal structure of the project requires you to enter it. You walk in through a pathway underground through a tunnel, and you see light literally at the end of the tunnel that beckons. And as you climb up the amphitheater into this square park within a park, you meet this expanse of green with hundreds of indigenous Indiana native plants that have been planted along the periphery. And the only thing that you can see are walls of plantings, gabion limestone rocks that are indigenous to Indiana, and the sky. And it's incredibly beautiful and minimal and reductive in terms of shutting everything out but the basic constituents of the natural world. And then, you know, you can sit in there, stare into space. You could do Tai Chi. You can read a book. You know, you can have a picnic. But you literally are inside the artwork. You're walking through it. You're activating it. You're completing it. Another project, which I think will become iconic for the city of Indianapolis, is Los Carpinteros's Free Basket. That's located at the 38th Street parking loop and the entrance to the project, which is also our handicap accessible entrance with parking. And that's a project where two Cuban artists have essentially created a full-size international basketball court that has somehow transformed into this surrealist landscape where you not only see the literal court itself, but you see the three-dimensional sculpture that reflects the trajectory of the bouncing balls from each team. So there are these huge red arcs and these blue arcs that represent the opposing teams, and there are basketball hoops. You can actually get out there and shoot hoops there. It's not going to be a logical basketball game if you play. It will be much more surreal, but it's already been amazing to see people interacting with it. And, you know, I mentioned to you before we went on air that we just had the annual conference of American museum directors here in Indianapolis for the first time since the 1970s, and we were showing off the IMA and the park and the facilities, and they ended their tour of the Art and Nature Park with about 100 of them standing on the court itself and with their jaws hanging open and smiling. And I said, it's a kind of project that you can't see without having a smile on your face. It just automatically appears. So there's a lot of joy in the park, I think, as well as contemplation. Some of the other projects, in terms of their interaction, we have a pier produced by Kendall Buster, who lives in Richmond, Virginia, and it's called Stratum Pier, and it echoes the topographical survey map forms for each level of the pier as it juts out over the lake. And from that vista, you can see Teija Mäkipää, who's a Finnish artist. You can see her ship, Eden II, that has a guard shack on the edge of the lake that people can climb up onto and see video footage of what's supposedly going on inside the floating ship. And then Andrea Zittel has a floating island, and that's a project that she's created where we also worked with her to run a competition with Heron School of Art students. And the winning students, Jessica Dunn and Michael Runge, have the opportunity essentially to become the IMA Island residents, and they're living on the island for 6 weeks this summer, and they're doing a relational art project in real time where they're going to be blogging about their daily life experiences living on the island. They're doing a hydroponic garden. They have a rowboat, and when they put a flag up on top of the island and people ring a bell over at the lake's edge, they'll row out and bring people on for a tour of their personal habitat. And they'll be talking to people about what it's like living on the park, living in the park and on the island. And And then we also have two other projects. One is By Type A, which is a two-man collaborative from New York. And they came and worked with the IMA staff for several years doing a team-building project. A lot of corporations and schools and nonprofits know about team-building. They decided to think about team-building as an aesthetic experience, and they worked with an interdisciplinary group of IMA staff ranging from custodial to security and night watchmen and retail and curatorial and conservation. And they worked with these folks for 2 years doing retreats and different team-building activities and talking about sort of the philosophical underpinnings of the park itself, what it was meant to be, how it could be realized. And then eventually that group worked with the artists in order to come up with a kind of sculptural metaphor for that experience itself. And they created this project called Team Building Align, in which there are two 30-foot wide metal rings that are suspended from three telephone poles, one on top of the other. And what happens is that every year during the summer solstice, as the sun moves around the Earth moves around the sun, the shadows of the two rings, which are reflected as interconnected on the ground, come into alignment and become one whole ring. And so it becomes really the most site-specific project we have in the park, because it's tied to the solar system and the galaxy, and it's some people have referred to it as Indianapolis's Stonehenge. And then I think I'm missing one other project, which is Jeppe Hein's Bench Around the Lake. Jeppe Hein is from Denmark, and what he's done is he's essentially created these benches that seem as if they're rising above the ground and then falling down beneath the earth and coming up at a different part all the way around the lake. They're bright yellow benches.
Sharon Gamble with Lisa Fryman of the Indianapolis Museum of Art. And just so you know, the Fairbanks Art and Nature Park is open during the winter.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buselli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter again next year. That'd be on Friday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 4. I'll find out about the upcoming Encyclopedia show at Earth House.
I'll get to chat with Kate Boyd about her new Music for the End of Winter CD.
And there'll be our arts calendar that we call
What'll We Do? So please listen next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4 to The Art of the Matter here on WFYI for your information.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support from listeners like you. And from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts, opening in January 2011. The Art of the Matter. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's Art of the Matter was produced and edited by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter on 90.1 FM, Indianapolis.